Okay, so this is recording now.
Okay,
so Mr. Casares, thank you for talking with me, and I'd like to start asking you about Brownsville, your story collection from about 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It seems very successful today at the end of the decade, because although ethnicity is present, you know, even front and center, you would say, it's stripped of an overt political agenda. So what do you think about that, and do you think if you wrote another story collection, would your style be different today?
I don't think so. You know, part of what I wanted to do in writing the stories was to write it almost from the point of view that I was inside the community, mm-hmm. writing about it. So mm-hmm. in that instance, there were certain things that I wouldn't necessarily discuss in too much detail.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously if I was writing mm-hmm. within the community, for people in the community, there are things that we would know and would be, it wouldn't be any need to point out to them. On the other hand, obviously, you know, I wanted people outside the community to read it, but I wanted the feeling to be that it was something that was, you know, very, very much within the community, very much a part of it.
Hmm.
The other part of it is that, you know, when you live in a when you live in a part of the country, like the border, where Mexican Americans are 96-97% mm-hmm. of the population,
mm-hmm.
it you know, the question of ethnicity and other issues related to that race and such aren't really the issues that they are in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
The question becomes more about class,
hmm.
for instance,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of the characters are struggling with, or on the right. On sort of the periphery of and sort of looking in on other classes. But the question of ethnicity is really isn't present, except for, you know, maybe one or two stories,
hmm.
And it's not something that I think, again, in that environment, people are necessarily aware of. You become aware of things like that when you are the other,
right?
You know,
minority.
When, yeah,
right, yeah,
yeah. And everyone has gone through that feeling,
right?
Whether it's because of you know, ethnicity, race, gender, but when you feel out of sorts, you feel like there's no one like you around.
Right.
So the question of writing, you know, stories from it within the community. Now, you know, if I were to write a collection, let's say based in Austin or Houston,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think it would be different, greatly so.
Hmm. Right. That's very interesting. So you're saying that you didn't feel as much of a need to explain things, which often turns into exoticism, right?
Yeah, no. You're coming into my world.
Right.
I mean, whether you're from Texas,
right.
or Minnesota, uh-huh. or some other part of the world, you are now entering my world, and so it's, you know, I mean, I've got to do my job as a writer to, you know, acclimate you to this new environment, but you also have to do your part to begin to sort of understand it on the level that it's being presented to you.
Hmm. It seems to become much more effective because of that, because you're not going out of your way to explain certain basic things. You know, you just take certain things for granted, and there we are in that world. You know, so
mm-hmm. yeah, no, and I, you know, that I mean, if you're, you know, anywhere observant, mm-hmm. and curious, I think, you know, part of going to a new place is not to ask too many questions,
mm-hmm.
but to just observe
mm-hmm.
and, you know, note those subtle differences, and sometimes there are big differences, and and not try to analyze it too much in the moment, but just to inhabit the space.
That's right. Yeah.
The other part. I mean, if there was a political agenda of sorts, it was one that I think by not talking about ethnicity, part of what the stories do is that they get beyond that issue, and
right.
suddenly you're reading them as stories,
right.
and suddenly you're looking at these people as people and not as an ethnic group.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
which, personally, I felt it was something that we needed. You know, again, if a political agenda was any part of this, I think certainly getting beyond the exotic and speaking about. Mexican Americans simply as people,
right?
Because I think that's been a large part of the reaction to the book. That there's something universal, and that sounds somewhat cliche, but there is definitely something very distinct about it at the same time.
Right.
So the combination of those two, I think, is maybe part of it.
Right. So in that sense, were you also reacting when you were younger, when you were first writing stories, were you thinking of the Chicano movement writers of the 60s and 70s? Was there some sense in which these were writers you wanted to write against in a way, if that's not putting it too harshly?
That's a good question. First of all, I didn't start writing young at all. What I consider young, anyway. I was already in my 30s before I started writing. I had worked in advertising for several years. And as I said, down on the border, the question of ethnicity is really not something that's on people's mind necessarily. Are you from this side of the border? Are you from the other side of the border? But beyond that, it doesn't. We don't really get into it too much. So it wasn't up until I moved from the border that I started hearing terms like Mexican American and Chicano,
right,
and Hispanic, and,
right.
and all these labels that that each came with its own baggage,
right.
To answer your question with regard to what had been written before, I was conscious of that. And I felt that those were all books that we needed, and there were probably others that we needed and didn't get published.
Right.
That should have been.
Right.
But part of the luxury, I guess, about writing about Brownsville was that it got me beyond that. That it gave us sort of a safe place to write about this. And I think get away from necessarily talking about the differences and talk more about the similarities.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I read both Brownsville and Amigolad, it reminds me most of Flannery O'Connor's work, because again, you know, she may be talking about a region, but she is so much in that world that you are, that the stories are become much more universal. And that's the word that comes to me, in, to my mind, when I think about your books. And it also seems to me to represent the best of what, you know, the Iowa Writers Workshop is capable of encouraging. And especially in terms of when I think of Flaubert's, you know, dictum to choose the perfect word, and I'm very much reminded of that, you know, when I read your books, the precision of language.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the short story is a wonderful way of you know, beginning that process and to keep yourself true to that, to that method of writing. But yes, I mean, I held on to the stories as long as I could, to have that effect. You know, I think part also of that is the the fact that I didn't start out as a writer. Or a reader, for that matter. And so, when I approached the story, I wanted it. The stories that I'm most attracted to are the ones that have that precision,
right?
That have that, and that I feel that everything is there for a purpose. And so, I mean, I think ultimately we end up writing the stories that we would like to read.
Right, right. Now, about, in terms of Amigoland, what was the genesis of that book? And did you already know you were going to work on it when you finished Brownsville? Or did it take you a while to understand your characters?
It took me a long time to understand my characters. You know, I must have written 300 or 400 pages before I actually had a sense of who they were and what shape this novel was going to take. The genesis of the novel has to do with a family legend that I'd heard growing up, and the story that my uncle used to tell was that our
Hello? Hello?
Great-great-grandfather first came to the United States, and as a child, he was living in northern Mexico, and Indians had attacked this this festival that he was attending as a child, and they took several of the children with them, and the Mexican army was behind them, and when they got to the border, which had just become the border, which had just become the United States 2 years earlier, they drop one child off and continue riding north, and that one child was our great-great-grandfather. And so I was fascinated with this tale. The other thing that really fascinated me about the whole thing was that my father claimed that it never happened, and that my uncle was making it up. And so, initially, I think I wanted to write about this this legend, but as I got deeper into it, I realized that I wanted more so to write about this conflict within the family, and this idea of this competing mythology of where we came from. You know, what is the genesis of this family? And that was sort of where I started off. As I got deeper into it, I knew that this was going to be told by these two older men. And then slowly they sort of took shape and became who they are now. But it was a very long process, and when I got to that point, I realized I made that tough decision, which was to understand that I was going to have to lose a lot of what I'd already written.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In material, but I was going to gain much more, clarity and understanding of the character.
Right. So the legend was there from the beginning, but not the the two older characters, Don Fidencio and
Don
Celestino. Right. Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Okay. So those two came later, but the legend was there from the very beginning, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Bronzeville is generally about young people, sometimes children, sometimes young men and women with their lives still ahead of them. And it seems more typical of minority literature in enacting, a slice of the American dream, or at least people trying to grasp for it. But Amigo Land is very much the opposite. It's about salvaging what remains at the end of a long life. So how did you shift gears so fundamentally from one book to the next?
Well, it's funny that you say that. There are a lot of young people in Brownsville.
Brownsville, yeah.
But I've heard the same thing in the opposite direction, which is that there are a lot of old people in Brownsville, which I never. I didn't think they were old or young. I just thought they were people. But I remember somebody wrote a review of the book when it came out and talked about how many old people I had written about, and it was only then that I became conscious of it. Mm-hmm. Writing of can you hold one second?
Sure. Yeah.
Part of my own history is that I grew up in a house with much older parents. Mm-hmm. My dad was 50 when I was born. My mother was 42. Mm-hmm. I was born the year of their 25th wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. And that meant that all my cousins were much older than I was,
right.
And I was sort of left in this kind of limbo. I still introduce people to my cousins, and they're 30, 40 years older than I am,
uh-huh.
and then much more so my father's generation.
Uh-huh.
So I think I had a pretty clear idea as to these characters because of that experience. The other part of this was that, and I had already started writing about Don Fidencio in the nursing home, and already had a basic idea of what Don Celestino was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2004, my father, who was 90 years old at the time,
mm-hmm.
fell, broke his hip, and ended up in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I found myself in nursing homes. I found myself helping out when I could with my father. But it also presented the biggest challenge in writing this novel,
mm-hmm.
and that was that my real life had intersected my fictional mm-hmm. life, my mm-hmm. fictional narrative,
mm-hmm.
and regardless whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, under the best conditions, you have some perspective on what you're writing about. You have some distance, and it's only with that distance that you can write about it objectively. Mm-hmm. But I was right in the middle of going through so many things that I didn't want to compromise the story that I felt I needed to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And compromise it by making it overly sentimental or just, you know, in any way sort of the story taking a turn that would make it less than what I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, and so I think in part it took longer because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, you know, obviously, you know, I saw more,
right.
Experienced more, had more to write about, but at the same time, it was a great challenge.
Right, you had to get a little bit of distance from it, right?
And yeah.
Longer to process the new information coming in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's talk about the central character, Don Fidencio. So he's the 91-year-old resident of this nursing home called Amigoland, and he's nearly debilitated with memory loss at the beginning of the book. Yet he remembers the most important thing of all, the origin myth, how he ended up on, you know, quote-unquote, the other side, how the journey to where he is now started in force a century and a half ago. And much of the rest of what he's forgotten is extraneous. So he remembers the most important thing, but everything else is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you say something about that?
Yeah, well, I think that... And part of this came from a lot of the research I did on memory and the dementia that oftentimes happens to people this age.
Mm.
You know, there is no set way that this occurs, but in a lot of cases that I read about, the memory loss happens with the incidents that are more are closer to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And those the memories that stay with us are the ones that are in those formative years, and also in large part and how we form memory, as I understand it, memory that we're conscious of and sometimes memory that we're not as conscious of, but we sense that we've been at a certain place or there's something that sort of lingers, a sort of residue.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to do with emotion, what emotional state you were in at that given time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the story, Don Fidencio obviously has a very close bond with the grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandfather in the story seems more of a father figure than necessarily a grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Takes him for his first haircut, spends time with him, something that Don Celestino didn't have the opportunity to experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the idea of losing you know, all this material all these memories,
mm-hmm.
is part, I think, based on the research, but also just on what I thought that the character would hold on to.
Would have remembered, yeah. Now, yeah, in both your books, the border as an idea is blurred. You know, what is this side? What is the other side? So, and the whole question is absurd in a way, because when you think about the fact that some people, you know, in the southwestern states have been living here since the early 17th century, when it used to be Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout Amigoland, we feel this blurring of borders. So, can you say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, the you're right. The question of the border is. I mean, I teach a class on the border,
uh-huh.
And we write the about the border and their experiences with it, or their families. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the things we talk about is that how difficult it is to get to any sort of conclusive answer about what the border is, and because it's not static.
Mm-hmm.
And it's constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously now there's a lot of attention on the border,
right?
Because of the wall and
right.
And the drug war going right. on in Mexico and such.
Mm-hmm.
But the in the stories and even in the novel,
mm-hmm.
the idea of the border is less of this idea of a wall or of a hindrance or some you know, the notion that you suddenly crossed into another world and that you're leaving everything behind, I think it just doesn't exist there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I know people who have this is fairly common, will get married in Brownsville and have their reception in Matamoros.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's very right. common. You know, obviously, it's less expensive to do it right. across the border.
Right.
And and you know, one of the other you know, principal characters in the novel is Socorro, the girlfriend of Don Celestino.
Right.
And she obviously comes back and forth mm-hmm. practically every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that you know, and that was just simply what I knew growing up. And the stories, in my mind, you know, were set in the let's say the 70s or 80s, perhaps the early 90s. I mean, I was down there just this past weekend, and it was the first time ever
mm-hmm.
that I needed a passport to get back
mm-hmm.
to Brownsville.
Mm-hmm.
And the you know, it was always a serious sort of point to cross over. Was, you know, you realize that, you know, you're dealing with a federal officer and
right.
so on and so forth.
Right.
But the it's changed so dramatically
mm-hmm.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
The number of Border Patrol agents down there and the various checkpoints that didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, it does feel like a military state.
Mm-hmm. So for younger people growing up in these border cities, the way that, you know, Don Fidencio feels about the border, or Socorro does, that might not exist in the future, perhaps, right? It might become a more sharper line.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
I would imagine
yeah.
so.
I can
see someone fairly young now
mm-hmm.
growing up under these conditions and that being part of the just what they accept as normal,
as reality, not thinking about the border as even you grew up thinking about it, I guess.
Yeah. I wrote a story not that long ago for Texas Monthly,
uh-huh.
and it was talking about these soccer players, a high school soccer team,
mm-hmm.
and it was about the tournament they had played and such, but part of what they had to do that they just told me in passing, and it told me as though it were, again, very common,
mm-hmm.
was that before the school bus leaves Brownsville, they bring on the sniffing dogs
mm-hmm.
to go through the entire bus,
mm-hmm.
and then the bus stops at the checkpoint, which
mm-hmm.
is in the King Ranch,
mm-hmm.
and you know, someone comes on and they can't, by law, they can't ask their citizenship because they are students. But nonetheless, the inspector comes on and you know, walks through the bus. I mean, this is something that if you're growing up in any other part of Texas, any place other than this southern region, mm-hmm. you're not having to deal with.
Right. Yeah.
So, I think, I mean, and I don't, I mean, I played sports when I was a kid, and I don't remember, you know, drug dogs coming on, and I, you know,
right.
I'm sure there was a checkpoint, there's always been a checkpoint,
right.
But the feeling and the sort of intimidation that registers now is so much different.
Right, not this level of intrusion and surveillance, right?
Yeah.
Another thing, you know, is this stereotypical journey of the Mexican is from the south to the north. You know, the young man who comes in search of a job, wanting to forget what's most central to the core of his memory, you know, just put the past behind him. Whereas Amigoland reverses the equation. The old man travels south in search of where he came from, wishing to retain the core of his memory. And this seems to me, it's in itself a more powerful indictment of current border politics than any overtly political fiction could accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and the other part of this is that they do it illegally.
Uh-huh.
You know, because they don't have any papers. The only
right.
one who has
right.
any right to be there is Socorro, as a Mexican citizen.
Right. So it's an illegal border crossing in the other direction.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I
didn't think of that.
And so it does sort of. You know, put that whole notion on its head.
Right.
You know, but I think also, you know, part of that for me was about this mythology, something that Don Fidencio in his mind owns. It's one of the few things he owns.
Uh-huh.
And so the question of the border and the crossing itself, whether it's legal or not, matters much less to him.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, you also seem to be questioning illegality, not in the narrow sense that we've come to expect in the current immigration debates, but illegality at a more transcendent level. So there is the much greater illegality of the arbitrariness of the border that you seem to be talking about, and even more importantly, the illegality of treating human beings as abstractions, right? So this gets us away from kind of the current, you know, muck of the current politics in a way. And were you conscious of that when you were writing the book?
I was conscious of it so much, as much as I am as I am in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
To a large degree, much like Brownsville, try not to let that influence what I'm writing about
uh-huh.
or how I'm writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
But just to get the story down, I mean, I tell people, you always have questions about you know things like the monkey's head and such,
right.
And,
right.
and if that's true and such, and I tell people that, you know, when you're from the border, you don't really have to make this up.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to worry about is getting it down
right.
on paper
there.
And
yeah.
telling it
right.
Honestly.
Right.
And so, you know, I did a fair amount of research. Crossed back and forth across the border, took several trips. I mean, I'd already been traveling for years into Mexico, but did it more with this idea of this trip in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then simply tried to tell the story as as I saw it happening. But yeah, I mean, certainly, and the climate changed greatly
during the writing of your book, right?
Yeah. Excuse me.
During the writing of your book, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I started writing this in 2002.
Right.
I mean, this is you know, obviously post 9/11.
Right.
But
still,
the southern border in particular intensified around that time.
Right. Right.
And you know, has continued to do so.
Right.
Particularly when you know, the immigrant marches took place a couple of years ago. So you know, it's you know, and that's in that same way as with my father, that becomes one of the challenges. You know, to write about it honestly. But as far as I'm concerned, to not let it influence too much of the writing. I mean, for me, the you know, the story is always what matters most. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm fortunate that I'm writing about you know, material stories, you know, that hasn't been given its due and have oftentimes misrepresented. You know, but again, I mean, that you know, my job is to tell it the way, you know, I see it as accurately as possible.
Right. Let me ask you a question about, you know, when he does find his, you know, place of origin, Don Fidencio, when he's back in Mexico at the end of the journey in Linares, and, you know, he can treat his ancient relative, Mama Nene, you know, with love and empathy, but he cannot, you know, muster these empathetic feelings toward the turtles, as he calls them, or the other assorted, you know, men and women at the nursing home back in Brownsville, to all of whom he gives endearing but, you know, reductionist and very funny nicknames. So why can't he treat you know, the people at the nursing home with any kind of empathy?
Well, a lot of that, I think, has to do with his ability, or his limited ability, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's gone through this you know, mild stroke, and it's impaired his memory.
Mm-hmm.
So the names, though cruel at times, are a way of coping with his surroundings, his unfamiliar surroundings, and the idea that he's you know, been placed here with all these strangers. And so a lot of that is simply the fact that he can't recall, and much of it, I'm sure if we analyze it long enough, would be about, you know, the resentment that placement brings with it.
Right.
With you know, regards to the end of the novel and the empathy he shows this relative, at that point, you know, so much of it is about his own survival.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we come to find out that the trip and even what he, you know, does with the medicines is you know, part of a larger sort of agenda that he's had to regain control of his life.
Right.
So, you know, I think that there is some empathy there. I also think that there's, you know, some self-serving agenda.
Right.
To try to, you know, make more out of this trip that at that point seems on very shaky ground.
Right, right. you know, once he reaches Linares, you know, Don Fidencio, it seems impossible to expect any fate for him, you know, other than to stay there, liberated, as he would call it, and, you know, I would too. And did you ever consider any other ending for him? You know, I also expected, you know, Don Celestino and Carmen to get married right there in the Linares town square, and maybe I got carried away a bit, but, you know, and I was really hoping that would happen, but maybe soon, but the ending for all three characters seems perfect, you know, in that it's consistent with their knowledge of themselves at that point. But again, so did you think about ending it any other way, you know, especially for Don Fidencio, or did
you know, I probably did. It's I can't think of what that other ending would have been. I know that just actually today I was cleaning out my office, and I had put up all these notes, these post-it notes, large post-it notes, all over my wall, my office wall, to have some visual sense of how the novel was evolving. What happens in this chapter, what happens in this chapter, and so and as I was throwing all that away, and as I was throwing away, I glanced at one or two of those post-it notes, and they seem so utterly foreign to me. And you know, I thought about holding on to them, and then I said that, but that's not the story, you know, that's you know, that's just you know, something else, and probably not something else. It might have been just something else. But, you know, again, sort of struggling with my father's condition. You know, as much as I wanted that not to influence me, I'm sure there's a part that crept into that. And you know, the idea of you know, certainly with Don Celestino, is he's struggling with the idea of this intimacy all along. There seems to be some break in the clouds toward the end, but there's a resistance there all along. And you know, the trip, as trips often do, you know, forces a lot of things to the surface.
Right.
And so, you know, that was mainly what I wanted the trip to produce for those two characters, Don Celestino and Socorro.
Right.
With Don Fidencio, I guess I didn't quite know where this was going to end. But I had a sense that whatever would happen would be on his terms.
Right. And maybe that's the reason why Don Fidencio and not Don Celestino is the central character of the book, because even though Don Celestino and his girlfriend Socorro, they help him, you know, leave the nursing home and take him to Mexico, they seem to recede in importance by the end of the book. And it's because, you know, and perhaps a similar fate as Don Fidencio does await Don Celestino, except that he just can't see it at the moment. But it seems to me that, I don't want to use the word idealism, but maybe that's, you know, what applies to Don Fidencio, or more of, you know, he just has this greater sense of, you know, wanting to be liberated, right?
Well, he you know, as a novel opens, he has absolutely nothing.
No control, right?
None whatsoever.
Right.
Very, very few possessions.
Right.
So he's on the other side of that. Where Don Celestino, you know, though his world is. Feels like it's shutting down around him. He doesn't have that much to occupy himself with. He's isolated to some degree from his family. He's still not at the edge of that half of what, you know, Don Fidens is experiencing.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, I mean, Don Fidencio, uh-huh, and the question of his fate is very present.
Right.
And at the beginning, he seems to, you know, be at the mercy of that fate, and that, and it looks pretty bleak for him.
Right. And he's more stubborn than his younger brother, and this stubbornness, you know, which is also very present in Brownsville, you know, this male stubbornness or machismo, if you will, you know, in Don Fidencio's case, this is very appealing. And is it because he's up against a rigid system of treatment of old people that is more dangerously stubborn than anything he could ever put up? And were you also trying to say something about the Mexican character in both books? It's saving grace in a way, you know, this, mm-hmm, the stubbornness.
You know, I suppose it's a little bit of all of that. You know, I think that the character himself, and you know, this is, you know, partly based on a lot of the older men that I grew up around, but the idea of sort of the pride they took in their work and how it sort of determined they were to take care of their families, mm-hmm, sometimes in spite of all their other flaws, you know, was part of this, character, you know, that the freedom that they, that they had, sometimes too much freedom mm-hmm, that got them in, you know, quite a bit of trouble. And so yeah, I mean, I think that there is, you know, I mean, a bit of that is part of the character, but you know, so much of it is just what I knew growing up.
And you know, to get back to Brownsville for a minute, you seem to rely on symbols to carry the weight of, you know, some of the stories, like the dead monkey's head in Chango, the hammer in RG, then there's the bowling ball in another story, and you seem to get the same visceral connection to reality in Amigo Land with the slow passage of time, especially at the, you know, the beginning of the book. Do you, in that respect, do you find the short story form inhibiting, that you have to rely on certain things that, you know, you may not have to in the novel simply because of the space you have to, you know, to show the passage of time and get the reader involved that way, as opposed to symbolism?
Well, I mean, with any of those objects in the stories, the you know, the monkey's head and the bowling ball and the, mm-hmm, I mean, none of them mean anything at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, the monkey head, mm-hmm, is just plain weird, mm-hmm, and there's no denying that, but it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. It only means something, you know, once you understand the character in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Then, and you have to understand that in order for him to let go at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's just a different form altogether. Mm-hmm. The efficiency within a short narrative always attracted me,
mm-hmm,
to it, and I think you know, a part of me wanted to have some sense of that, hold on to as much as possible of that, mm-hmm, when writing this novel.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it covers a much larger span of time.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us point of views, multiple point of views.
Mm-hmm.
But I challenged myself to try to pare it down to as much as, you know, to try to not have anything extraneous in there.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did include to make it mean something other than simply, you know, sort of background material.
Right.
I wanted you to have a sense of why you were reading this, why this was important.
Right.
And I ask myself that constantly. Why is this important?
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't that important, then I tried to make it important, or I questioned why I even had it in there.
Mm-hmm. Are you very careful about putting words on paper in the first place, or do you just write a lot and then discard and, you know, subtract? It seems to me the latter, probably, right?
I take a long time, and it's painful, and it never happens in an easy way.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, once I've written something, it generally doesn't go through too much editing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But once I get it down, and so, you know, I mean, I'm, in that way, I guess it evens out.
Right, right. Did you experience something like, you know, the little town in Mexico? Did you kind of do, I hate to use the word research, toward the end of writing the book, did you kind of, you know, experience that directly, you know, as you were writing the book, or?
Yeah, well, I did it on the front end.
Oh, okay.
And actually spoke to the state archivist of Nueva León and had a long conversation with him, and so I found quite a bit of documentation to back up the story within the story of
mm-hmm.
my grandfather.
Right.
And then also to get a feel for the community itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, at a certain point I understood that I wasn't writing a historical
novel. Sociological document, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a travel log for that matter.
Right.
So everything again in there had to have a reason for being. But I, you know, I probably, I don't know, made 5 or 6 trips to Linares.
Okay, but the sense of the community in Mexico is not something you had as you were growing up or as a child or anything. This is something.
Oh no, no,
okay,
no.
Okay.
No.
This comes much later. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. One thing, you know, I read, you know, in Dagoberto Gil's, you know, anthology, and he says at one point you were in an undocumented illegal workshop with couple of other writers with him. What's that all about? And also, you know, you mentioned advertising, and you know, I always thought that writers should do something else before they become, you know, full-time writers. So do you think that helped you, actually, the advertising, you know, the business, you know?
I think it did, particularly with the short story, because obviously there's a resistance
right.
to people listening to advertising. That's not the first thing that they
right.
think about listening to or reading.
Uh-huh.
So, and there's a great efficiency to it as well,
uh-huh.
Because you have 30 seconds to explain everything you're going to explain about a product or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I think that helped the discipline
uh-huh.
in meeting a deadline.
Uh-huh.
And be able to focus on getting something done. Yeah, absolutely. It was mm-hmm. a great help. I think it probably would have taken me quite a bit longer had I not had that experience.
Right. Journalism can, you know, help in the same way. I think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Although that has its dangers too. But anyway, what about this workshop with Gil? Was this like when you were in advertising, and that's when you started, you know, thinking about writing stories? And you?
No, I had I'd started writing in the summer of '96. I
okay.
wrote really for the first time
mm-hmm.
seriously that time,
mm-hmm.
and about 5 months later, I quit my job.
Hmm.
And college, and then mm-hmm. eventually I took a class at Southwest Texas, which is now Texas State.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I signed up for the class, they said that I, you know, I couldn't be in the class because I wasn't you know, part of their MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
And so so anyway, Dagoberto had this workshop that we did. I mean, we met a handful of times,
mm-hmm.
and it was very helpful. And the next time that the class at Texas State was offered, they did allow me in,
mm-hmm.
based on the work I had done.
Done, yeah.
In that time,
right.
And you know, a couple of those pieces ended up in the book itself.
Right. So you did that for a few years, you know, like in South Texas before, you know, was it like in 99, 2000 or something that you went up to Iowa?
Yeah, that workshop with Dagoberto must have been in 98, and then I went to Iowa in 99.
And you were just writing stories all the time, not necessarily publishing, I guess, right, but just...
No, I didn't, well, I started publishing in 98.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Right. Okay, so I'm, you know, pretty much done. Do you want anything to add, or, you know?
Not anything I can think of.
Okay.
But I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, so it was great talking to you, and I hope everyone buys Amigo Land and also checks out Brownsville, which is, you know, together they are just fantastic, you know, they add to each other. So
well, thank you so much. Yeah. This is a great interview, and I appreciate your very close reading.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was my pleasure. So let me just turn this off.